Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, we look back at the origins of the JEA criminal case with City Council President Ron Salem. Later in the program, an attempt to revive plans for a self-storage facility for a third time is once again met with opposition from San Marco residents. But first, as the effort to sell JEA began to collapse under the weight of scandal, a City Council committee was formed to ask questions. Now known by the names of its co-chairs, the Diamond-Salem hearing played an integral role in exposing and snuffing out a plan that ultimately resulted in a criminal prosecution. I'm joined now by City Council President Ron Salem. Welcome.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here, and we welcome you to join our conversation as well. You can reach out via social media. You can give us a call at 904-549-2937, or you can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. President Salem, the former head of JEA, Aaron Zahn, was convicted earlier this month of conspiracy and wire fraud in his attempt to profit from the sale of JEA. His colleague, Ryan Wanamaker, the CFO, was acquitted. Is that outcome satisfying for you personally? Is it satisfying for the city?
It is to me, because clearly through all my investigations and my time on the council, I always thought that Aaron Zahn was the ringmaker. And there were several people, his lieutenants, for lack of a better term, that were involved as well. Ryan Wanamaker happened to be the one that was indicted. But it did not surprise me that he got off.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Zahn's conviction, did you see that coming? Was that something that you thought would happen?
And as you remember seeing me in the courtroom, I was over there several days during the trial. It was important to me to watch it and feel it, because I had invested so much time into it. And I thought the prosecution did an excellent job of presenting the case. So it was no surprise to me that he was convicted.
So the Diamond-Salem hearing was in late 2019, in December, and it was really the first public vetting of the planned benefit scheme that was created by JEA executives and that was ultimately the core of that criminal case. How consequential did you feel that meeting was at the time, and what kind of response have you gotten since from people who investigated this case or prosecuted this case?
Well, I got just a little bit of background on that hearing. Councilmember Diamond and I were asked by the administration at the time to conduct that hearing on the PUP. We had a notice meeting on that particular meeting occurred on a Monday. We had a notice meeting, I think, on the Tuesday before to decide how we were going to divide up the responsibility for that hearing. And we were told by JEA that we would have the documents the next day, which was Wednesday. On Friday of that week, we finally got the documents. It was 800 pages of documents. And because of the sunshine law, him and I could not talk. So we both individually spent the weekend. And I must have spent 12, 14 hours a day reading through those, writing down questions. And the comments that I got right after the hearing was how effective it was. In hindsight, we know that Mr. Zahn and Mr. Wanamaker lied to us several times. And it was really neat for me. I was asked to appear at the Garrity hearing that occurred a couple of months ago leading up to the trial.
Over the summer
to document the fact that Mr. Wanamaker and Mr. Zahn were volunteers there. They weren't coerced to come there. And Mr. Tyson Duva, the prosecutor, indicated to me it was a central part of their case, was that hearing. And they showed clips several times during the hearing.
And explain,
during the trial,
remind us why that was so important and why prosecutors were showing excerpts from that meeting to jurors.
Because we were able to, through the documentation, just for example, going back to the infamous July 23rd board meeting, we were able to show that board members were not did not get a review of the agenda. We were able to show that the PUP plan was in the last 10 minutes of that board meeting, and board members thought it was a $3.4 million plan versus hundreds of millions of dollars. We were able to show that that Ryan Wanamaker did do calculations. I was getting texts during that hearing, I'll never forget it, of JEA employees telling me to ask Mr. Wanamaker about his whiteboard in his office, because apparently he had done calculations on his whiteboard and then erased them. So there was so many things that came out of that hearing that Tyson Duva was able to use in the prosecution.
Tyson Duva, of course, the lead prosecutor on that federal criminal case. So part of the presentation that Tyson Duva presented was not just the PUP as a get-rich scheme, but it was, you know, he told the jury that the entire sale process was a fraud perpetrated on the public, on the city, on the council, and that it was orchestrated or at least enabled by other city leaders. Is that how you feel now? I mean, do you feel like it was a fraud from the very beginning?
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember the solar scenario that solar is going to be taking over and the JEA is not going to exist as it is today. And if we don't do something soon, we're going to lose the ability to sell this asset. There were so many things that we were told as the council that just were not true. And we've since have found out the people that watched the JEA, the other agencies that were looking at JEA were wondering, why are these people saying this about JEA? Because it's a strong company and it's not going to go away. So we were misled. The council was misled. The public was misled from the very beginning.
So, I mean, help me think through if this, you know, was a fraud from the beginning. How do you feel about the former mayor's role in appointing Aaron Zahn to the board, of essentially clearing the decks of the previous board, of, you know, as we heard in testimony, ousting, being behind the ouster of the former CEO, Paul McElroy?
Well, clearly, Mayor Curry wanted JEA sold. There's no question about that. Aaron Zahn was a person that was going to perform that task and that job. He clearly wasn't qualified, and we have since learned all that, and never should have been in that role from the very beginning.
But, I mean, at the time, the mayor was saying he wasn't pursuing a sale.
Well, he said in his reelection that he would not introduce legislation to sell it. He never did, but the board moved in that direction right after that 2019 election.
Was that a conversation you were having with him? Like, was he talking to you or other city council members about a sale, or saying that I really do want a sale, even though publicly I'm saying I'm not going to support a sale?
I never had those kind of discussions with Mayor Curry myself. Just never came up.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to, at the time, Curry said that the JEA board, it was taking on, quote, very serious threats to the future of a government-owned utility. And he said that JEA had conducted the process openly and in accordance with the law. That was kind of when this was all blowing up, right around the time of the Diamond Salem hearing. Do you believe he believed that?
The problem that I saw began at that July board meeting. The board was misinformed on the condition of JEA. They didn't ask the questions they should have.
But do you think the mayor was misinformed about the state of JEA? Because he was repeating that.
He was repeating that. I assume he believed that. But we have since found out that that was not the case.
And so insofar as, you know, he had a role in inserting Aaron Zahn, placing him there, as you say, unqualified for the role, basically led the city down this path to scandal. Do you think that the mayor has done right by the community in terms of acknowledging that fact or atoning for that fact?
Well, I think the comments I've seen by the mayor is that he has said what he should have done is taken this whole idea to an entity like the Civic Council very early on and vet it through that kind of process versus going immediately to JEA. And I think that would have been a better process.
Sure. But I mean, at the time that he was urging you all on the council to put your foot on the gas and hurry up,
yeah,
and get this process through, was right at the same time the Civic Council was weighing in and saying this is a terrible project. It is riddled with problems. The community has lost faith. We need to stop it. And he was pushing for acceleration.
Clearly, after the committee meeting where Kyle Billy released the PUP.
Kyle Billy being
the council auditor. Council auditor. I called it mind-boggling. It was the headline in the paper next day. We could see that plan was unraveling the whole JEA sale, and you're correct. That's when the Atlanta meeting occurred, the sale of the JA was accelerated, and then days after the hearing that Councilmember Diamond and I conducted, the sale was canceled, Zahn and Wanamaker were terminated, and the whole thing stopped.
But you don't see Mayor Curry and shake your fist and say, man, this, I mean, really almost happened on our watch.
No. I mean, I think there were several. I blame Zahn and the team there for what happened. They misled everybody. They the ones that obviously are going to jail. It was just orchestrated that way.
But you don't think it was orchestrated that way by the mayor?
No, I do not.
Okay. We're talking about JEA. We're also going to talk about other city business before the city council. I am here with City Council President Ron Salem, and we invite you to join the conversation. You can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also reach out on social media, and you can call us at 904-549-2937. So is this issue put to bed? Are you comfortable with where we are now with JEA?
Yeah, I think as a city and myself personally, I'm ready to finally close the book on this.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel like we finally have justice after 5 years. And the few of us that were first termers, now second termers that are still around, I finally feel like that as a city, we can move forward.
And you feel like you've played a significant role in that?
Well, there were several of us that did. I feel like I did, and there were several on the council. Those that led the special investigative committee should feel good about this. So there's a half dozen or so. Scott Wilson, who's now working for that set up the special investigative committee under a lot of pressure not to. So there were a lot of heroes on the council, the auditors, et cetera, that should feel good about this outcome.
There has been some chatter on social media about there should be a movie made of this whole process.
I think a documentary of some sort should be done. No, it's just too interesting.
Yeah.
Not to.
Yeah. I want to talk to you, shift gears a little bit, and talk about a proposal for a new jail. So that's something that has been batted around for a long, long time, but you really have made it a centerpiece priority of your, you know, presidency, and it really is moving ahead. So explain for people who may not understand why you've decided that now is the time to do this, and how do you address the fact that we're basically going to be looking at kind of $2 billion projects simultaneously between the stadium and what all estimates suggest a jail would probably cost?
Well, to go back a second, at my installation speech last June, I highlighted the jail and said this was an issue that we had talked about in this community for years and nothing had happened, and I was going to move it forward. And I set up a special committee chaired by Michael Boylan, who's done an excellent job of moving that process. We've had all sorts of hearings, community meetings. We've gotten some great information, and you're right. What has excited me is now the jail is at the top of discussion. UNF did a poll, and a new jail was more popular than the stadium, which was just shocking to me. So
why do you suppose that is?
I'm not sure, but I was shocked by the result that, and as I go around town, people are now understanding when we talk about mental health and healthcare in the jail, people are now understanding that we have a facility that is not providing the kind of care that we should be providing in our jail. And it's become a topic of discussion. And as your listeners probably know, the sheriff is looking at vacating the police memorial building and moving that part of the operation to the Florida Blue building, which will be
in Riverside.
In Riverside, which will be a significant part of this. I think he'll be putting out an RFP in the near future to hire a consultant to look at locations, design, size, and all those things. So, we need to do this. And I hear those that say we've got a stadium and a jail. Fortunately, the council, I think, was wise to put $10 million into the existing jail to make some repairs on elevators, electrical systems, which will buy us some time on the jail. so we're not moving both items at exactly the same time.
We've got a call. Charles on the West Side, good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hi, Ron, I was wondering if for the summer, has City Council allotted the funds and everything that's needed for the pools to be open for the kids this summer? You know, to be staffed with lifeguards and whatnot?
I know that's been a major emphasis of Mayor Deegan in her budget, was to make sure those pools are open and staffed. And I've talked to the parks director, and I don't think you're going to have the issues you had last summer, assuming we can, due to COVID and those things, get the parts and equipment that we can get to make sure the pools are open and working well.
A call also from Jim in Riverside. Good morning, Jim. Go ahead.
Hey there. I know we drifted a little off the JDA topic, but I want to thank all the elected officials, public officials like the city auditor and the journalists for really putting the brakes on selling our public utility twice, really, in the past 6 years. So now that we have saved it, what can we do with it? I know that JA has been looking for a growth revenue stream for a while now. What would the councilman think about JEA becoming an internet service provider?
An internet service provider. I mean, that was kind of one of those, I think, maybe somewhat far-fetched, you know, ideas that were put in the ITN as like a possibility, right? If there was a variety of things that JEA could get into that were not directly related to generating energy and selling water.
Well, one of the things that has come up through this discussion is our method of running our various authorities and the boards that are overseeing them. And as I've gone around town, it's critically important that those boards are very active, asking questions and truly managing those entities. I just made a JEA appointment a reappointment of Rick Morales, and I have a second appointment as we speak that I'm interviewing candidates for. And one of the things that I do is to make sure they understand the importance of those positions. They don't understand something, ask the question, because the chances are if you don't understand it, somebody else does not. We never want to be in the situation we were with the JEA where I think board members were not as in tune as they should have been. And I don't mean to be critical of some of our citizens, but clearly that was an issue with JEA.
Have you gotten any sense from those former board members about how they feel about their time? I mean, many of them were called to testify. And as you saw, you know, during that testimony, very often they're being asked to watch the video of themselves, you know, making announcements and proclamations about how important this moment was. They all seemed to recognize it was a really important moment. They were deciding to possibly sell the city utility. And yet that care wasn't taken, as you say, to really delve into what was the consequences could be.
I think they feel misled like many of us were. They drank the Kool-Aid like many of us did in terms of believing that JEA was not going to be able to exist as it was. Could they have pursued it to a much higher degree? I think they could have. But I know many of them feel terrible about what happened. And I've heard from them, which is why as I interview board of directors for the port, the airport, JTA, I go through these same questions. We are counting on you as board of directors to manage these entities that are critical to Jacksonville. And if you're not capable of putting in the time and effort to ask the questions, please don't serve.
That's a daunting, you know, task. And I would guess that anybody applying for those positions would look at what happened to the JEA board and really, you know, almost quail. I mean, that's a lot to think about, that they might, on their watch, something like that consequential could happen.
Absolutely. And if they feel that way, don't serve.
Yeah.
I think there are enough people in this community willing to step up. We need to make sure they're the right people to step up.
We do have a listener email on the topic of JEA saying, Mr. Salem, it's obvious that for political reasons, you're not implicating former Mayor Curry, but it's obvious he and his cronies were in cahoots to sell the JEA short-term gains to steal the JEA from the citizens of this community. Do you feel that, well, I guess, what's your answer to that?
I mean, as I said, there's no question that Mayor Curry was pushing to sell JEA. I think that's pretty obvious, and pushed it till the very end, all the way into December with that Atlanta meeting and such. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what else you could say.
You don't believe, though, that he deserves any more blame than just saying, you know, that he was duped.
Well, I've never seen any evidence, and I think it became clear that they were completely unaware of the PUP as the rest of us were. And that's really what changed everything, was the release of the PUP and the worth of that. There's been no evidence that I've seen anywhere that anyone has presented that the mayor's office knew anything about the PUP before the council and the rest of us found out about it.
Sure.
Now, clearly, he continued to push the sale after the PUP came out. And that's where I think at that point we should have stopped the whole process.
Right. Although I guess, I mean, back to kind of the presentation that we got from the prosecutor, it's, you know, not just the PUP that was the fraud. It was the entire process that was a fraud.
Absolutely. And we know more about that today than we did back in those days. We all believe that possibly JEA would not exist as it stands today with solar and all these other explanations.
Do you believe that this is forever a dead issue now?
I think so. I can't imagine anyone bringing this up again. And that's kind of the sad part. I mean, debating the sale of JEA could have been a reasonable topic to discuss. Obviously, it just turned very bad very quickly.
I want to turn back to the jail issue a little bit because I've heard some really interesting discussions. I know that people on those committees have gone visited other jails. There's a lot of input that they're getting from the mental health community, from the criminal justice community. Is there any discussion at all about the kind of incarceration rate of Duval County versus other counties in the state? It's very high.
I saw the article that I think David Barreline put out was strictly based on population. And what I don't know is how Jacksonville as an urban city compares to some of those other areas. It's an interesting statistic. We are housing somewhere around 3,000 inmates today. I think clearly we need to build a facility that can house at least that number as our population grows. We need to have better services for healthcare, an infirmary of some sort that we really don't have today, mental health. I've been at the forefront of our mental health offender program where we're diverting people out of the jail, providing them mental health services and getting them back into the community. All that needs to be considered. And we clearly need more of a campus style facility versus the eight-story building we have now.
Right. Which is, clearly not serving the need that it has. But is there any real conversation happening when we discuss, for instance, capacity of the jail that addresses whether, you know, there are other ways to divert or other ways to, you know, see that people are not warehoused there for long periods of time?
Well, clearly, I think we need to treat those with a mental health problem differently than the hardcore criminals. And I think everyone's in agreement with that. And we need an infirmary so that we're not, I mean, we are spending $6 million a year transporting inmates from the jail to UF Health.
Were you surprised to learn that?
I was shocked to learn it was that much. And, of course, I initiated through our council auditors a study of UF Health. And as we found out, a third of the indigent care UF Health does is inmate care. So much of that could be performed in a jail if we had an appropriate infirmary and those kinds of things. There's tremendous dollars that can be saved through this process.
It's crazy when you think, you know, we're paying for the transport of those inmates. We're also paying to some extent for some of that indigent care at that hospital. So we're kind of paying both ends.
And we're paying for security at the hospital. We've got to have a private guard outside the door 24/7 to guard that inmate.
I want to ask you on the issue of homelessness. So there's this new unfunded mandate that was actually, you know, sponsored by a local legislator. The city's now going to have to pay for some sort of facility for homeless people. How do you anticipate funding that? How is it frustrating to you that that mandate's been handed to your council?
Well, this is one of the areas where I think there's some synergy between the mayor's office and the council. I set up a special committee on homelessness that's chaired by Joe Carlucci. That committee has identified a funding source, a permanent funding source for those services. And we are moving forward with a diversion program as well as a program to assist the chronic homeless. What the state legislature did recently is just going to accelerate that process. I met with Mayor Deegan yesterday. We discussed this briefly. I think right now everything's on the table in terms of how we meet that mandate, whether it's a school, a building. I'm a little leery of a tent city type program that I just don't think that will work very well. And it's not only the physical housing them, it's all the services you have to provide as well.
Which include?
Healthcare, mental health services, you have to feed them, all those types of things. So it's quite an undertaking, particularly to have it in place by October 1.
What are you looking forward to now as your kind of the second half of your term as council president? What are your remaining priorities?
The stadium. That's probably the biggest item still on the agenda, is to get the stadium deal hopefully passed. If not, while I'm still president, soon thereafter. The Laura Street Trio is still out there. We're hoping to see that come back in a form that the council is comfortable with, and hopefully we can move that forward as well over the next 2 or 3 months.
Well, Council President Salem, thank you so much for being here today. I hope you come back and visit us again soon.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Thanks for being here. And we'll be right back with a controversial self-storage unit that just won't die.
What's up?
Welcome back. Well, it could be called a zombie development after two failed attempts to build a self-storage unit facility in San Marco. A developer is back with a third attempt. To discuss the community's take on this plan, I'm joined by two residents of San Marco in the South Bank, Gianni Vivian and Pam Sorensen. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, Gianni, this is the third time at least the third time this project has come up. Why do residents object, and why does it continue to resurface?
Yes. The continue to resurface is a mystery to us, but the objections are very clear. One is that where they are proposing to do the storage unit, it's a very busy area already. It has been zoned for residential and some retail. And so we envision now a bunch of U-Haul trucks coming in and out the whole day. The latest proposal is also proposing to have over 100 residential units on top of 500 to 600 storage units on top of retail. So aside the aesthetic, we don't really understand the logic behind it. So.
And for people who aren't familiar with this location, this is actually where Flavors of Thai is currently located, but it's
correct.
Right near BB's restaurant.
Right across the street from BB's, yes.
And so the area it's Hendricks Avenue at Prudential. It's mostly, lower rise buildings.
That's correct.
And so part of the concern is whether it, you know, fits the mood of the, or kind of the, as you say, the aesthetic of the neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
But another controversy is that there was an overlay that was created. Pam, explain to us how this, I mean, the overlay explicitly prohibits this kind of development, right? It prohibits self-storage units.
You're exactly right. And people need to know that. It was developed in 2019. It was a public-private interaction. They came up with a well-thought-out plan for planned growth. As Gianni said, it was for retail and residential, specifically omitting storage units because it's zoned a mile or two away appropriately. And tax dollars have come into play, making our road diet on River Place Boulevard. You know, people come down to the Riverwalk for sip and stroll. They live down there. We have the refurbished Friendship Park. Storage will not draw people to our neighborhood.
So the reason that that overlay was created in part was to prevent developments like this. So how is this development avoiding that explicit prohibition?
It is not. And as a matter of fact, we strongly believe that at the end of the day, the only thing they're really interested in is putting storage units. Maybe it's a very profitable business. So they seem to have been able to kind of push that part. But we have attended a lot of meetings, and in no meeting there was ever a statement made of the need for storage there.
But they're able to bring this back, I guess what I'm saying is they're able to bring it back because they've married it to a new project, right? Can you explain a little bit how that's working, Pam?
Well, it's just a go around. It's just a way to get around the zoning by calling it mixed use. And we're all for residential and retail combined, that sort of mixed use, but we're not for storage. We were not for storage the first time. And basically, this is the developer's go around to end up with what he asked for 2 years ago, four stories of storage on that corner.
But it is the idea of low-income housing, or not, excuse me, affordable housing, right? That would be part of this project that wasn't previously, not previously residential.
It was not, the second rendition did not have residential. We are not against affordable housing. We would love that space to be affordable housing and retail. We're against storage. And we are against the taxpayers paying $6 million in incentives for 100 units on top of this storage. It adds insult and injury to placing something that's unwanted, not zoned for, and making us pay for it.
Explain what that money, where it would come from, and why that would be a taxpayer-funded element of this project.
It is an incentive for the affordable housing. For the, Vescor is the developer for the 100 units. But the majority of the project is still storage. There's 13,000 retail on the bottom, over 136,000 of storage units. As Gianni said, it's going to be over 550 storage units.
It's interesting, this new approach is, it resembles something that happened recently in La Villa, where there was a controversial project for a gas station, but it was kind of presented, packaged into a more of a mixed use environment, you know, bar, restaurant type thing. And so it seems like that can give developers another bite at the apple, so to speak. Gianni, what... Is this kind of the same thing?
Yeah, I think it's exactly the same thing, is that they learn through the process or what the what could sell to the council and the DIA. Okay, and then
the Downtown
Investment Authority. And then they come back and say, okay, here it is now. We're now addressing that part. Not really clearly stating that, you know, the opposition is not on the housing itself, it's on the storage. So the storage keeps on coming back, and it keeps on being embellished by other things that would cause different problems too. So,
And so what are the stages that this project must yet go through in order to either get the money to finance those units or to get approval for the, it needs rezoning, correct?
It does need rezoning, and we are on a fast track. Last year's rendition, we had a longer time to fight this and get organized. And the one thing I learned with last year's fight was that the city runs on alphabets. So there's the DDRB, there's the DIA, there's the LUC. I had no idea what I was getting into. But yes, we have some more meetings. The final vote will be April 23rd, a short, not even a month away. But it's amazing. Businesses have come together to fight this because it will hurt them. City Grill, which will be steps away from a storage facility, was just named this year as one of the 15 top new restaurants in Florida by USA Today. And you're going to put a storage facility steps away from that. BB's restaurant is across the street from it. It's just, it really is infuriating.
There's also a meeting tonight, though. What's happening?
Yes.
And I see you're both, for people who can't see, you're both wearing no self-storage stickers, big yellow stickers on your chest.
Yeah. And it is obnoxious, but you have to do it because people don't know unless you tell them about it or until we get some nice media coverage like you're providing today, because people need to know that we're just people. We're just people trying to protect our community. And it's hard to fight money and power. It's not a level playing field.
Sure. How are you acclimating to that, Gianni, that reality? I mean, it is, to just be an ordinary citizen, it's a strange thing to step into.
It is. Pam has been involved longer than I have been. I've been involved on this particular project for a year and a half. We were really happy when last June the council turned it down, and we thought that's it. We finally, all the effort that we put in was worth it. And now it comes back, Pam said, on a faster path. I personally also went to the meeting to present this. And when I looked at the picture and the way it was discussed, I was trying to understand, how did it get this far?
Yeah, because typically if a project is rejected by the council, there is a period within which it cannot be reintroduced unless it's substantially different. And so the idea here is it's gone through this transformation. Now there's a lot of housing attached to it. Yeah. And so it qualifies as substantially different.
Yes.
That's correct.
Kind of a loophole there.
Yes. But you just really kind of wonder if this developer will ever stop. And if it gets turned down this year, good heavens, what will happen? What could you possibly throw onto this project to make it different next year? It really kind of boggles the mind.
Do you have the support of your district council member?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we met with him the other day. He cannot come out 100% with the decision because he has to go through the proper process. But we believe he is supporting us.
This is Joe Carlucci?
Joe Carlucci is listening to us.
He has said that he respects the overlay, the 2019 comprehensive overlay. And that's what we're asking for. It hasn't even been 5 years. It was planned growth that yields progress with, you know, limited consequences. Stick with the overlay, uphold the overlay.
Do you think citizens who are, you know, aren't from San Marco, maybe, you know, an entirely different neighborhood, can take any lesson from the experience that you've had in terms of, you know, fighting this project and having it come up again and again?
Yeah, I think so. As a matter of fact, we've been talking to people in Murray Hills and other areas where they are into similar situations, but did not have the opportunity to do what we're doing right now. It's truly an opportunity because of the dynamics of our neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people are interested. We loved our place. We can walk to the Riverwalk, and we saw the great improvement on River Place. So all that is, you know, I've lived here now for 12 years, and I've seen progress. Having the fountain reopen was another beautiful experience.
Friendship Fountain, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when one of the first meetings I attended about 10 or 11 years ago was at the convention center, and it was called Jack's 2025, if I remember correctly. There must have been about 300 or 400 people there discussing and planning about what should Jacksonville look like in 2025. And now we finally see some of these things happening, but all the work that was put in on the overlay of 2019 to set that image that would attract people to the area, now it's being, you know, just arbitrarily overwritten. And that will set a precedent for other areas. That's why we wanted to be here. Today is St. Marco and the South Bank. Who's going to be next?
So you have a meeting that you're going to attend tonight, just a council meeting?
It's a city council meeting. It'll be the second reading of the ordinance, and there is a public hearing, and so we will be speaking there tonight as well.
And do you anticipate a turnout of people wearing these stickers?
Yes, probably for the next month.
Okay. And so you've got this city council meeting. Are you going to be attending these other board, these with
yes,
the letters that you were talking about, the DIA and the DDRB?
There's a DDRB meeting on April 9th at 2 o'clock. That's a Tuesday. And it'll be here. It'll be at City Hall, in the Linwood Roberts room. And it gives the public an opportunity to let the review board know what we think about this. And then there is the LUZ meeting on
land use and zoning, right?
Yes. Oh, you know all the letters. Yeah. That'll be the following week. And that's at 5 o'clock at City Hall Council. And then the final vote will be April 23rd. And we hope that this will be finally voted down and put to rest.
Is the administration involved at all? The Jacksonville mayor, I think during the last iteration, the mayor was kind of involved.
She definitely knows about this project.
Yes.
Yeah. And does she have a position as far as you know?
We do not know. Obviously, she's also respecting the process of having to go through the council and so on. So we don't know at this point in time what her reaction will be if both the development, the Downtown Investment Authority and the DDRB turned it down. And then the council approves it. So we're not clear on the process.
The CPAC, which is the Community Planning Action Group, they have unanimously opposed it.
Yeah. Well, Gianni Vivian, Pam Sorensen, we'll continue following this issue, but thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And stick around. We'll be right back with an annual art festival in the heart of Mandarin.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Heritage Publishing produces the annual Healthcare Guide and the Duval County Medical Society Membership Directory. Both reach healthcare providers in Jacksonville and Northeast Florida, providing opportunities for local businesses to reach these professionals. Info at heritagepublishinginc.com.
I'm Robin Young. People are eating out again, but a chef took a survey. They're not as happy. One reason, he says, restaurants used to focus on good meals. Now,
you have to be a content creator half of the time to be able to get people in the door. But half of the content creators are creating a dish of food that no one will ever eat.
The state of the restaurant industry, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
It was one of the worst civil rights violations in American history. The federal government's incarceration of more than 125,000 people of Japanese descent during World War II. Now their names are on display inside a Los Angeles museum.
We were going to give people their dignity back by making sure we didn't leave anybody out.
I'm Scott Detrow. We'll take a visit on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
The CDC has issued a health alert as the country faces a growing tally of measles cases. The number of domestic infections this year already matches the total seen in 2023. What's behind the surge in a disease the U.S. declared eliminated 2 decades ago? And what steps can you and your family take to stay safe? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Join me, Courtney Lewis, this Sunday at 7 p.m. on WJCT's Classical 24, 89.9 HD2 for the Jacksonville Symphony's encore performance of Beethoven's Fifth. Information at jacksymphony.org.
Welcome back. The longest-running arts festival on the First Coast returns to Mandarin this weekend. More than 100 artists will gather to display their work nestled among the oaks on the grounds of the Mandarin Community Club. And I'm joined now by the Mandarin Community Club Festival Chair, Susie Scott. Hey, Susie.
Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Glad to be back and talk about the Mandarin Art Festival.
Yeah, so this has been an Easter weekend tradition for decades. When did you first start attending?
I've been volunteering for about 20 years and chairing for about 15. I'm just about to lose count.
Oh, well, tell us about what it is. What's the experience like? What makes it a standout art fair?
It's different from most art festivals because of the surroundings primarily. Most art festivals are located in parking lots or street festivals or even large civic buildings. But this is in Mandarin, in the heart of a residential area, under the magnificent oaks of Mandarin.
Yeah, which are beautiful and storied, and a reason a lot of people like to go to Mandarin. I would guess that the artists really like that setting as well. I mean, it must be a draw for them.
Oh, it's spectacular. Many of our artists have been returning for decades, and this year we have about 40% new artists, so it's a great balance of artists that people are familiar with, that they come back year after year to see and buy their products, and new artists. So you have a totally new experience every year.
And so who does the art festival, I mean, obviously the artists sell their wares and that's benefit for them, but does it also benefit the community club, the Mandarin Community Club?
Yes, it's actually our primary fundraiser and our signature event every year. The Mandarin Community Club just turned 100 years old last year, and on the heels of that, we're hosting what is probably going to be our largest show ever this year. We have over 130 artists this year, 16 green market vendors, and an array of new food vendors as well. So, and we're also featuring our brand new, newly constructed outdoor Harriet Beecher Stowe Pavilion will be open just in time for the festival on this weekend.
Is that where that new sculpture is being made or has been made of Harriet Beecher Stowe?
Actually, the Harriet Beecher Stowe sculpture will be going down the street. But we're partnering with the Mandarin Museum and Historic Society. They actually have a presence on our property. We lease them the historic post office and general store, and they'll be open over the weekend. So you can kind of step back in time over at the store and then cruise through the art festival and enjoy a really complete, unusual, unique experience.
What does the community club do?
We are a civic organization. We focus on beautification, preservation. The Mandarin Community Club building is one of the most, I'd say probably one of the top 10 historic structures in all of Jacksonville. It's a 170-year-old building founded by Harriet Beecher Stowe, who used to reside right across the street.
And was it in the intervening years?
It has been a community club for, as I said, just over 100 years. But prior to that, it was a place where people came for community meetings. The Mandarin Players were there for many, many decades, which was the probably the most successful amateur theater group in the United States for quite a long time.
So what's the connection? This is kind of an Easter tradition in that neighborhood. What is the connection and what are some of the events that tie into that holiday?
Well, the The actual festival was founded in 1968 by one of our past presidents. And most people don't know, but Mandarin was a bit of an enclave for artists. Memphis Woods, Charlie Brown, the famous potter, and even now Ford Riley has resided in Mandarin, and Kenyon resides in Mandarin. So the idea of having art and a festival in Mandarin is kind of a tradition.
So there are local artists at this event. There's also some national artists. And it looked like a really interesting mix of folks. One that kind of caught our eye was that there's a graphic designer that does book covers for people, including Margaret Atwood, Dan Brown, John Grisham, that Michael Windsor is his name. He'll be there showing some of his paintings. But there's a lot of different variety of styles.
We have six different categories for our artists to exhibit under. And we're quite pleased with the depth of talent from our artists this year. It was quite a surprise to get this particular artist coming in after we read his resume and seen that he had done the original covers for those that level of writers. We also have artists coming from all over the United States. We have them coming from South Florida. We have them coming from Atlanta. We have them coming from Indiana. So there's a real depth of talent.
So the Mandarin Art Festival, it runs March 30th and 31st. Starts at 10 o'clock each day?
That's correct. We open at 10 a.m. each morning. We close at 5 on Saturday and 4 on Sunday. It's not just a feast for the eyes. We have some really unique food vendors this year with an array of international foods, empanadas, pierogies, gelato, Argentine food, Latin fusion. So it's a feast for the eye and a feast for the taste buds.
Well, it's really nice to see you, Susie Scott. Good luck with all this weekend.
Thank you. Come on out.
All right. And that's our program. We encourage you to send feedback or suggestions for future segments to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, or you can find our entire archive at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our show is directed by Brady Corum. Join us again tomorrow when we talk to local Haitians and refugee aid groups about what's being done here to respond to the crisis in that country. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.